Welcome to the ENIS Network podcast series. ENIS stands for the European Network on International Student Mobility that aims to connect research and practice. Enjoy our podcast and get to know the latest news on international student mobility.
Good morning. Today we are gathered here at Vilnius University to hold our second podcast of the Working Group 2 of ENIS Network. So our Working Group 2 is about social inequalities in access to and during ISM, and it concerns with variables of inequality in ISM such as gender, age, socioeconomic status and ethnicity. So with that focus in mind, I have today two very important guests who are also early career researchers with us, Yingyang and Zainabdin, and it's a pleasure to have both of you here. May I ask you both to briefly introduce yourself in just about 3-4 lines about your research also, so that our listeners can know what your work is about. We can begin with you, Ying.
Thank you, Sanem. Thank you. Good morning. I'm Ying Yang. I'm a PhD researcher from the University of Manchester. And I almost approached the end of my PhD journey, actually. My PhD is looking at the role of education agents in prospective international students' choice making, which really related to how prospective international students get access to international higher education. I think it's really resonate with the theme of our projects and its projects. Yes, over to you.
Yes, now Zenk, could you tell us a little bit about your research?
Sure. Thank you very much for having me today here. It's a pleasure to be here and record our podcast with you and also with Ying, and to know more about her research. I think this is one of the best things of ENIS as well. So my name is Zain. I'm working as a doctoral researcher at the University of Eastern Finland. I'm at the stage of trying to publish my research, which is why I think a podcast is very timely right now. Yeah, so thank you. Let's continue.
Could you tell us a little bit about your research?
Okay, yeah. I'm trying to publish three papers, three single authored papers that I'm going to talk about today. The first one is on multi-stage international student migration from Pakistan and India to Finland and Sweden. The PhD title is basically Migration for Whose Benefit? Integration Remittance Sending and Migration Behavior of Pakistani and Indian Students in Finland and Sweden. Why I chose this topic is, one of the reasons why I chose this topic is because there wasn't so much research at the time when I began my PhD at some non-English speaking countries, and especially not on two South Asian countries, and India is the second top sending country. And Pakistan also sends a large number of students. So the first article basically focuses on why they chose Finland and Sweden, because the usual trend is to go to the UK or the US. And there are then some people or some guys from Pakistan and India who started to come to Finland and Sweden. And so this was a kind of interesting trend for me to see. And I really found chain migration, because somebody who picked on Sweden's free education came here before and then informed others, okay, this is, you know, how you apply and how you do things. There were Facebook groups formed, and then they just guided others and they started coming and moving away from the UK. One of the things that made them do so is, you know, easier English requirements, because at some you had to pass an English language test to go to the UK, but you didn't have to do it always when you're coming to Finland and Sweden, especially to avoid larger fees at that time. But the key argument of the first paper is that international student migration could be multi-stage. The current research on the international student migration is limited to the first stage, migration to the host country, and then whether they're going to stay or leave. But there is a higher possibility that they might migrate within the cities, from one city to another city, for different purposes. For example, to look for a job or to maybe find another degree afterwards they have completed their first the initial degree that they came for. So this stage was missing. Yeah. Between the two stages.
So what I understand from you is that apart from filling a very important empirical gap that exists on South Asian student mobility to Europe, your work is also looking at something very innovative, looking at the multi-stage migration patterns. That is super interesting, and that is the reason why we brought both of you together to talk about India and China, which are one of the biggest centers of students worldwide. So I would now turn to Ying to ask something innovative from your research that you want our readers to know, listeners to know.
Okay, thank you. This is an interesting question. The role of education agents actually is still little known, but widely used in international students' recruitment application campaigns, actually. So actually, this role is closely intertwined with my prior work experiences as well. So that is why I feel it's worth it to have a deep look at in my PhD journey. Agents, it's a kind of a business body, a business entities charge fees from the both service users like overseas universities and prospective international students, particularly those from China and India. These large population of international students, and because in the context currently in the context of the marketized international higher education, I'm wondering how this kind of business role functioned in these kind of particular campaigns, and whether marketization influence students' choice or motivations and or universities thinking about their potential students, because especially in terms of admission criteria for prospective international students, it's a completely new application system. How this particular cohort digests or interprets this information and to better prepare themselves to apply for the intended programs. This will seem effectively function in these perspective. So I'm wondering whether it's possible whether it is possible for students to have better understanding of the new system or the new field through in this way, and which can be, how to say, agents for me sounds like an information broker, whether it effectively functions. Perhaps it plays a role like, maybe it's my assumption, I think it might be potentially building a kind of equalities for potential students, because at least it helps students to have better understanding of something new, especially programs, how to provide, apply for overseas programs, and understand their positions within this kind of application game. So I think it's very interesting. It would be very interesting to have better understanding students' thinking, and also from this perspective, to we can understand what authentic intention of the universities for their potential students, because based on students' reflections on their application experiences, it seems currently the admission criteria sounds a little bit vague for them, while some information are published online explicitly, but for them it's not enough to well understand how to choose the potential programs, how to guarantee the place of certain programs. Because now, as the application number goes up sharply, it seems the application game is very competitive for them. They expect to have the opportunity to advance their positions in this game. How and in what way, who is the best helper, this kind of thing. So I think agents may function on this aspect.
Yeah, fascinating. I think your point about information brokerage, particularly your provoking thought that perhaps they are equalizing the field, is a very big takeaway for all of us, and I think something to ponder. I think it's really, really fantastic. So now I will come to Zen again, and maybe you started speaking about your first publication. Perhaps this is the time to talk about your other ideas as well as publication, by telling us your work's relevance, especially in the European context. And then I'll come to you being with the same question. So if you could think of your work's relevance in the European context.
So in terms of European context, I'm researching two countries who are non-Anglophone European countries, Finland and Sweden. Finland is a Finnish country, European country that is a country of, or used to be a country of emigration, but then there came a lot of international students into the country. So it is telling, I could say safely, that it might be turning into a country of immigration rather than emigration, which is a good thing to notice. Sweden, on the other hand, has always been a country of immigration. There has been a lot of migration even from Finland to Sweden, but then there was not so much research on international student migration on these two European countries, especially not in terms of, if you dig deeper, there's not so much knowledge on the remittance sending behavior, which my second and third articles are also focusing on. And it's also a stage where you could really see inequalities become apparent in terms of the socioeconomic statuses that I would be talking about a bit later.
Okay. Ying, could you tell us about your work's relevance for European international student mobility?
Sure. Especially post-COVID-19, and some marketing reports indicates that students have already considered, they actually applied for programs from different countries rather than just focusing on one particular country like UK, USA, these kind of popular host countries. In terms of cooperation with agents, these kind of practices actually happened in many non-English speaking countries, like other European countries as well. So I assumed impact of agents rather than does not focus on like a popular host country now has already expanded its impact. Perhaps currently the financial issues take place for in different cultural contexts, like European country, other European countries as well. So and also lots of universities across the world develop these kind of contracts with develop co-work with agents, recruit as many students as possible. Now, as I know, more university develop international programs. Their targeting population are international students. How to approach these students for learned a lot popular strategy is using this kind of business body to disseminate their reputation programs. So lots, I think, agents wrote the impact, or they play a kind of more important role. But how can we use this role well and understand this role, the potential functioning this role in equality, educational equality? I think we need more research or discussions about that.
Yes, absolutely. We need more discussions around that question. And I'm glad you brought the topic of COVID as well. Although for now, already it seems like it's behind us, and its repercussions are going to be felt for many years to come. And now I want to go back to Zen on your point about remittances. And before I could ask you, I also want to interject and say this is something very new for the field of ISM, International Student Mobility. Because nobody sees students as remitters, you know, not at this stage. It is always usually afterwards, after the labor, quote unquote, labor market integration has already occurred. So yes, go ahead and please tell us a little bit more about this very unusual linkage between South Asian mobility, remittance sending, and becoming a student.
Thank you very much. So to begin with, I would like to carry on this point forward, that there is really no research on remittance sending behavior of international students And on top of that, there is, or I couldn't at least find any research on sending behavior plus receiving behavior, because before, like you just said, before they are integrated into the labor market and they have found themselves a job and they are able to, you know, survive on their by themselves, they are usually reliant on the money from parents from back home, from South Asian countries in rupees, converting it to euros. So it's not always easy, of course, but this is how they survive in their initial stages. So I was talking about earlier about my first publication. So the theory I'm using, one of the theories that I'm using in this paper, is translocal theory. So the point there is that instead of placing the focus on countries, you should focus on cities. And one of the points of deduction from there is that once you focus on cities, you can see that students, especially if they were not able to secure admissions in bigger cities or capital cities with a lot of jobs, if they end up in smaller cities and they don't really have jobs over there to find work for themselves and to support themselves, and on top of that, if they have obligations to remit back home, then they really need to travel to bigger cities. So what my participants did, or what I observed over 10 years of my ethnographic research and on top of interviews, is that they would want to complete their coursework immediately and then try to move on to the bigger cities where there are ample jobs, to find a job to sort of stabilize themselves, and on top of that, try and send remittances back to their parents or brothers or whoever supported them. So there's this reciprocal obligation kind of going on, and this is also where the second paper comes in. The second paper basically observed their remittance sending and receiving histories for a period of around 10 years. So the main finding I found from there is that there's the first stage is where they are receivers, the second stage is when they find a job and they are senders, and the third stage is where they have their families often rejoin them in Finland and Sweden. So they have now their own families to take care of their own children, and they have usually bought a house, especially in Sweden, because the Swedish community of international students is a bit older than the ones in Finnish, in Finland. So then they are like, okay, now we have our own very high expenses, and they stop sending. So these are the three stages that become prominent. And the third paper is where the inequalities really become visible, because the third paper talks about what kind of jobs did they end up? Did they end up as an engineer? Did they end up as a pizza deliverer or a food deliverer? And one of the key factors in establishing that is their financial background, from their social economic status from back home. So if they're not very affluent and they could not afford to receive heftier sums of reverse remittances to be able to support themselves, they would find any sort of job and just found themselves trapped in that. There is Hanve Lee's research on Finland talking about, you know, this weak integration trap, and that means once you start earning, let's say, as a food deliverer, you start, and the income is really good in that food delivery job in Finland, or used to be really good until recently. So you start earning, and you haven't earned before ever in euros, and then you're like, okay, what am I doing now? I'm earning. What am I going to do after I complete my degree in IT? I'm going to still earn. So why not just keep in that job? Why do I have to struggle to learn Finnish so much? And why do I have to learn, go an extra mile to do my degree? Instead, I would just stay in this job and keep sending money back home. So our students often don't even complete their degrees. And where does all of this start from? In unequal socioeconomic statuses from back home. Those who are from the richer backgrounds can afford higher remittances, don't have to go and work odd jobs. They can stay in the university cities longer, achieve better grades, finish their degrees sooner, and then find engineer or IT relevant jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something where inequality really, really diverts their whole paths towards careers.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you. So students from receivers, then becoming senders, and then with families again having a different pattern of sending and receiving, or perhaps not doing so. Excellent. Thank you very much. So I see that there is also this contrast emerging, although you both come from very different research focuses. You talk about the ways in which inequalities sort of come to the fore through behaviors like remittance, sending and receiving. And you talk about how educational brokerage of information in the educational field is something that may have a very equalizing potential and sort of maybe even democratizing potential of how information spreads and how people make choices. So I really like this kind of a contrast that you are bringing, and I think both of these points are very innovative. With this, I think we are almost towards the end of our podcast, where I would really want you to tell our listeners about how Innis Network has helped your research careers. I'm assuming that both of you are members of Innis since the last couple of years, like me. So maybe we'll begin with Ying.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. Like I said earlier, I'm super, super grateful for joining this group. Wonderful people, especially for international PhD students. I pursue my PhD in UK, so my understanding about the global tech context may be focused more on UK, but this group really opened the door for me to understand the world. Especially every time the group meeting, especially in-person meeting, I had great opportunity to have face-to-face conversations with scholars across Europe. I understand they try to learn different cultures, the differences between the researchers and their topics. Their topics, their personal experiences, gave me a kind of a feeling, like contrasting feeling, really fresh my understanding. Wow, that is such a big world. The differences make a difference for me, especially when I understand agents. I prefer to treat it as a kind of a moneymaker industry. But as I approach more scholars within this fantastic group, I found potentially, yes, agents generate money, but at the same time, bringing more information, which sounds like creating a route, a possibilities for newcomers. They have understanding, like open a new world for prospective international students to understand different countries, which help them to make choices, make a kind of value for money choices, or consider more like, because now they tend to study in a popular host countries like UK, USA, UK, USA, Canada, Australia, these kind of countries. But how about Europe? Other countries like Vilnius University. It's a good choice. This time we had organized this kind of a meeting, which really helped me to understand, wow, this is a good city. And in terms of the students, buildings, environment, I think it is a very good choice to consider. But in terms of understanding of these kind of countries, to be honest, I feel literature or in practice students seem to be less familiar. So I think these kind of organizations, these kind of projects really, really bring in different insights into potential choices of destination country, potential programs, and help them to have more choices and get access to a broader international context.
Wow. I'm really impressed that actually you have sort of given us, the Innis Network, one of the biggest compliments by saying that how your research matured over the last 1 or 2 years after interacting with Innis members and understanding. So from purely looking at brokerage from a market perspective, business perspective, you're also trying to understand a social role. So that is, I think, one of the biggest compliment we could have gotten. Thank you very much. Now I will come to you, Zen. Could you tell us how you've benefited from Innis Network as an early career researcher?
Yes, yeah, that is a topic I'm eager to talk about, because one of the biggest problems I faced while doing my PhD is that my supervisors are not really from my field, not from remittance sending, neither from migration. So joining Innis Network has opened doors for me, doors towards opportunities, doors towards learning from the best in the field. I still remember when I was trying to still find out my topic, and I was reading through the literature, I would find most of the papers I would find were from Christoph. Mm-hmm. And then I got to meet Christoph. So what best could you do, you know, when you're learning from the one who's publishing the research in that field and is considered a pioneer researcher. And then other than that, I got to present my research at various platforms, and I got very important feedback because now I'm presenting my research to the fellow pioneer researchers who are working on the similar topic and can really provide me with the positive or negative feedback or critical, creative critical feedback that I really need to improve my research. And that's really proved useful when I presented my research, for example, yesterday here at Vilnius University at the Working Group 2 meeting. I received wonderful feedback from Thais, from everybody around me that I could really use when I'm trying to publish my research. And other than that, it's just been learning, very steep and high learning curve for me during the whole period that I have joined ANIS Network. I think that I wouldn't have been able to do or even improve myself in terms of doing research on international student migration if I hadn't joined this. And one of the messages I would like to convey via this podcast is that if you are anywhere in the world and working on international student migration, please join our network. Please join ANIS Network. You would meet wonderful people here and you would not regret your decision. I can guarantee that.
Thank you so much. That was supposed to be my closing remark.
Okay.
By taking your examples, because as you know, since we discussed this yesterday, our working group has a lot of researchers from early to mid-career, but not a lot of PhD students. So I was thinking where both of you, we could sort of, you know, spread the word and say that how much you have learned and improved. Thank you again. You also did a fantastic job, Zen, by telling us how much your learning curve improved or grew after joining the network, especially given that you people were not from the kind of field you were working on in your university. So I think this is one of the best advertisements we could do for ANIS Network. Thank you both very, very much for joining in. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much for having us.
This podcast was powered by the European Union-founded Coast Association.